This is what I want to talk about today. The thought to idea to action conundrum. I have a thought. I entertain it, or, said differently, I put my attention on it. And after I do that, it forms into an idea. I glanced at a picture on the wall. I continue to look at it. I label it, I define it, I interpret it, etc. I say to myself what it is. It's a painting of a Paris street scene. I judge it as pretty, as nice, as inviting. It reminds me of, etc. Those interpretations activate feelings in me. For me, the feelings are peace, nostalgia, appreciation, fun, good feelings. They trigger desire, too. If I now want to return to Paris, I will give my attention to that idea, which could be labeled, I want to go back to Paris. Between this idea, I want to go back to Paris, and taking action, the steps that are necessary to make that happen, are a lot of thoughts which will arise to me. And those are going to be unique to me based upon my past experiences. All the energy patterns that we have stored that are related in any way to travel or any other aspect of this desire are going to exert a certain degree of influence over us. And in my case, in this scenario that I'm describing, the aspects include Paris, the country of France, Europe, airports, packing, luggage, TSA, security at the airports, passports, hotels, taxis, cars, language, rates of exchange, money, normal foods, wine, cheese, etc., etc., etc. A tremendous number of energy patterns are associated with this concept of Paris for me. Some of these energy patterns within our inventory of comparison material, think of it like this. I want to do something. I want to think about something. All the information that I currently have stored in an inventory is going to come up for comparison to what it is I think I want to do. And it is that idea that some of this comparison material, some of the stuff I have stored in my inventory, is going to pull me. Some of it is going to push me. Some of it is going to hold me back. And maybe some of it is going to be neutral. Ho-hum, no big deal. The strength of those energy patterns, and we all have them, are determined by our perceptions. If I say a perception is an interpretation, or an impression, or an opinion, or a belief, you get it. So things are going to be filtered through our perceptions. So let me go back to that as an example. Paris. Walking in Paris. Stopping at a restaurant with sidewalk tables and chairs. Looking at a menu. Not being able to speak or read or understand French. What do I perceive? If I perceive embarrassment or some other negative experience, that experience of sitting there or going there or the idea of going to Paris and sitting at one of those tables, it would be a negative experience. But if I know enough to point my finger at menu items and allow a waiter to perceive what I want, you know, if I point at the fifth thing down on the menu on the left, I think he probably could figure out I'm interested in either ordering or knowing more about the fifth item down on the left. If I can do that, and it's okay with me, I can have positive experiences. In fact, it can mean that I can go any country, anywhere in the world, and be able to get along without knowing the language. So my world, based upon that set of perceptions, would be larger than if I don't speak French, I don't speak Japanese, I don't speak Chinese, I don't speak a thousand different languages, and so I can't go there. In that scenario, in others, perhaps the real issues come down to this. Do I know enough to order, or do I know enough in order to express my energy? Do I know enough to express my energy? What are my perceptions of my own expressions of energy? Do I feel bad that I can only point my finger? And consequently, I don't want to put myself in that situation. And then thirdly, how do I perceive the possible reactions of other people to my expression of energy? What do I think the waiter or anybody else is going to say or do or look like because I don't speak their language? This brings me to this interesting situation. The first order of business, are we enough? Capital E. Are we enough? Do we have experiences in our life that support this? So it would be comparison material, right? We have an inventory of being enough. So do we have experiences of being enough? Where maybe pointing our fingers or nodding our head or shrugging our shoulders was an example of effective communication, and it helped us get our needs met. And will others perceive us as enough? Or will they not? And will they act like we are not enough? Here's another interesting concept that pertains to this scenario of thought to idea to action conundrum. It's like, how do we figure this stuff out? And this idea is degree of belonging. What degree do we belong? Of course, you know that's a perception, right? We all want to belong. It's part of the human condition. Probably it's the part of mammalian beingness. If we're mammals, we want to belong. Why? Because if we belong, we're going to get nursed early in our lives. We're going to get supported, sustained, nurtured, and nourished. So that would indicate we belong. And that's one of the reasons. It's a survival and a social instinct that says, hey, if you belong, your chances of survival are much greater. You don't belong, you're shunned, you're neglected, you're left out. Not so good for you. We want to belong. We want to belong to our family unit, to people who will ultimately or possibly become our mates. We want to belong to groups of friends. We want to belong to business groups, to social groups, to groups that we initiate, that we create. Hey, anybody want to belong to a group related to? Fill in the blank. And so on. We want to belong. Then the questions become this. Using the Paris scenario again. Do we belong at a table in Paris, even though we don't speak French? Do we fear that our attempts to order wine, cheese, bread, and other things will make us feel, because it's about perceptions, will it make us feel as though we don't belong? Oh, I'm a fish out of water in Paris, France, because I don't speak French. Okay, that's a perception. And will the waiter's behavior indicate to me or us that we don't belong? Will he look down at nose because we only speak English or, in my case, English or Spanish? This overall questioning could be used not only on a Paris scenario that I'm hypothesizing about, but on any activity that we want to engage in. Do we belong? Do we have fear about our attempts? And will our attempts make us not belong? And will other people involved in this activity, can they or will they, or does it really matter whether they convey to us that we don't belong? My wife, Marianne, teaches about personalities when she was doing consulting around the world. in about 105 countries, actually, teaching global sales teams how teaching the top 20% of salespeople in large companies how to be like the top 2%. She would teach about personalities. So I believe now, because she's taught me a bunch, that personalities play a part in this. Some people will feel the need to have a perfect level of knowledge before any action can take place. That's a certain personality type. Other people would say, you know what? They're willing to jump into action because only their own opinions of themselves in the situation count, not other people's feedback or input. Well, hey, I decided that's all it takes. I'm going to take action. I've justified my action because it's my opinion. Other people need a lot of social approval from others before they can do anything. Well, what do you think about this? And what do you think about that? And let me what do you think? I'm going to go ask my best friends and ask your best friends and so on. And then the fourth major grouping of this personality profiling system that Marianne has used over the years is people who go, well, why do we need to take action? You know, the status quo, you know, the way things are right now, the world's not coming to an end. Why do we, it's safer just not to take action. Let's don't make waves. Let's don't create any kind of stress. Let's leave everything the way it is. You might be able to see that some of what I've been talking about reflects on an attitude of self-consciousness. Self-consciousness is how I see it. Do we belong? Do we fear? And will others indicate if we belong? Those are the examples. It's all about us. It's all about us. And frankly, this has dawned on me some years ago. I noticed it in action in my own life. In order for me to have a problem, I have to make it about me. I have to make it about me. If it's not about me, then it's a challenge. Okay, let's solve it. Let's look for the solution. Let's reach out for it. Back to Paris. People watching, socializing, soaking in the energy of the environment. The first time I was there walking on streets that perhaps Napoleon rode a horse on, like, oh man, oh, this was the coolest thing. Creating work for the restaurant, you know, customers make work. That's a good thing. The winery has to produce wine because I was going to order it. Farms have to produce the wheat because I was going to order bread. And they had to produce the cheese because I was going to order cheese. Basically, sitting there at a table, on a chair, on a sidewalk in Paris, creating a vortex of appreciation, creating a vortex of enjoyment, and loving, using this definition of love, attention, respect, and appreciation, are some of the actions that we're actually taking, some of the thoughts and ideas that we are having in that environment. I travel fairly frequently outside of the country, and it surprises me that when people, Americans, are in a certain place, they compare where they are in a foreign country to home. Well, that's not how we do it at home. Well, this would never happen in my hometown. This would never happen in my city. This would never happen in, like, and it always struck me as weird. If you're looking for your hometown, why would you go to a foreign country? If you wanted to see the same things, why don't you stay at home? Why would you go someplace that's different and not expect to experience different? I'm like, that's a head-scratcher for me. But when we're sitting there and we're respecting what we're experiencing, without the need to change it, without the need to find fault, without the need to criticize it for being the way it is, we become other conscious, not self-conscious, other conscious, which to me enables a greater energy flow, that flow to us, in us, and through us. In self-consciousness, it seems like we're spinning our wheels, kind of like we're spinning our energy in place. Maybe our attention is like a hamster on a treadmill of self-focus. The energy is not going anywhere. It's just going and whirling around inside of us. Like, not that productive. Not that productive. Maybe we could hook up some sort of electricity-generating thing to a hamster with a treadmill, and then it would be productive for us. Hamster would be getting good exercise, which would be of value. But when that energy is spinning within us, a vortex, like kind of like an internal stressful tornado, not very productive. But self-consciousness is a natural condition. We need to be aware of ourselves as individuals. I'm different than the chair I'm sitting at, or the microphone, or the headset I'm talking into. I'm different than the computer. I'm different than you. I'm different than the cabinets in my office. I'm different than my wife and my puppy dog. We need to know that. We have to have that awareness of ourselves. Christ says in the Christ Returns Reveal Startling Truth in Letter 5 that the first driving need of the ego that is going to be expressed through the personality is the need to defend the self from criticism, emotional, or physical attack. To me, that is exceedingly important. You want to know what's going to happen with a person, yourself included, myself included, is that driving need is going to be available, maybe waiting to get activated, or just automatically activated. This driving need is going to influence us when we consider extending our energy outward through the expressions of our actions. I want to do something. That driving need is going to go, depending on our early life experiences with criticism, emotional or physical attack, we will be more or less defensive when the time comes to take action. Somebody who's been safe and recognizes this is okay and it's a benevolent world, taking action seems natural. So their energy of defensiveness is not there. They're waiting for, all hell to break loose, not there. If our need to defend ourselves is extreme, and it is, depending on childhood experiences, we will not extend our energy pleasantly very often. We may venture out to extend our energy and go, yeah, I'm going to extend my energy. Oh, excuse me, but why do you have your fists up? Why are you gritting your teeth? Why are you getting all kinds of aggressive? We will extend our energy aggressively as our fight impulse. We're not thinking of fleeing, we're thinking of fighting, because that's the way to defend ourselves. And every situation is a battle that we're either going to fight or run away from. Whoa, there's a healing opportunity. There's a healing opportunity. And you can see it in the behavior of yourself. You can feel that come over you, and you can see it in the behavior of other people. Ooh, you can just watch them pull back. You can watch them put up their dukes, metaphorically or in actuality. You go, wow, something just got triggered. Some fear of criticism, emotional or physical attack, being made wrong, or the consideration of a new idea. Uh-oh. And then you're like, okay. And if it happens to us, and I'm certain it does, now it's a question of how often and how extreme it is, but that's a great thing to be able to heal. It is those beliefs that we are still threatened, that are held in place by these memories of past experiences. So we're considered doing X, and all of a sudden we're going to consult our comparison material, and this inventory of things even remotely connected or associated with X are going to present themselves as a, don't do that, too scary, too threatening, don't do that. And if that occurs, that's a healing opportunity. And if it, when those things pop up and we go, oh yeah, this, that's just me, that's just me. I've heard people say that when they display a behavior that's really counterproductive, not only to themselves, but to other people. Oh, that's just me. That's the way I am. Yeah. If you're not willing to consider, heal, reevaluate, review, transform these beliefs of threat and danger, we're going to be prisoners of childhood experiences, or maybe even earlier events in our lives. Those interpretations will form the bars of the prisons. And a person who says, ah, I really want to be successful, but they're prisoners, they're going to have a great deal of difficulty moving through their defenses to take action. It's like your lips are saying you want to be successful, but you are behind your wall of defense that will not let you come out. But there are starting points. If we want to move or we want to travel, we know our starting point. It's like, yeah, of course. That's important. If you want to go anywhere, you need to know where you're starting from, because that has a dramatic impact on the directions and the means you're going to use to get there. If I say to any one person, how do you get to Los Angeles? They would all like, they would start talking about from where they are. But when they're done, I said, I was talking about somebody who is in Long Beach, California. Like, then different directions. We will know the starting point if we want to move physically. If we can determine what we now know, the knowledge that we now have. So now I'm talking about moving or growing mentally. Say we need to learn something. You know, we want to study a map of Paris. We want to learn a new language. We want to learn a new piece of software. What do you currently know? Where are you now? What is your starting point? One of the interesting things to me is if you've done something one time, doing something new that's considerably related to it becomes easier. In Europe, when you talk to somebody and say, hey, which is what I always do when I meet somebody in a restaurant or a taxi or on the street, how many languages do you speak? And when I get 3, 4, 5, 6, and I've heard 7 in Brussels, in Bruges rather, it's like, wow, 7 languages. Wow, that is the coolest thing in the world. But it's known by linguists that if you know 2 languages, the 3rd one is much easier. And if you know 3, the 4th is easier still. What does that mean? Because people who have learned how to learn languages know how to learn the next language, and it's easier for them. They have some sort of capacity, maybe neurologically, they've got receptors for it, but I could also say they know how to go from the starting point to where they want to go. It's like, that makes kind of sense to me. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about moving emotionally, we want to progress from where we happen to be. Emotionally, every time this subject comes up, you know, I get angry or fearful or sad or prideful or you name it. It's like, so that's your starting point. Okay, that's your starting point with regard to that particular object of attention. That's cool. Now, what are you going to do in order to elevate your emotional state, to elevate your consciousness with regard to that topic. In the topic, thought to idea to action conundrum, there are four different topics about which we could have certain energy patterns that help us or hinder us. Thoughts. How do we feel about thoughts and thinking? Can we think? Are we allowed to think? Is it dangerous to think? Are we good at thinking or bad at thinking? Has our thinking caused us or other people pain in the past? And because the ego is so influential in our lives, think of that. It's like, it's on our shoulders. It's going to... What does our ego say about our thinking? Did thinking lead to being criticized or emotionally or physically attacked? Did our thinking fail us in our effort to come in first in the race of life? Did our thinking fail us in our efforts to take the best for ourselves? Did we get pushed out of the way by someone else? I didn't think that through very well. Or did our thinking fail us when we tried to hold on to what we had, our possessions, our property, our money, our friends, our families? Was our thinking faulty? One of the worst things that can happen to a person's thinking is for the child to be bombarded with degrading labels of "you are stupid," etc., and the variations about that. Being labeled that way, or being overcorrected, as a client said to me the other day, he was experiencing shame based upon what? Oh, I was overcorrected by my parents, overcorrected by my parents, overcorrected by my parents. Because those kind of things, that being degraded or overcorrected or in other ways to have our ability and our belief in our ability to think sabotaged, leads a child to deny their mental abilities. Even the self-judgment, this is a child doing it to him or herself, because I thought that, I had a bad thought, so that makes me bad, or that was wrong, or I'm stupid, or fill in the blank. When something doesn't turn out the way we expected, does that happen in life very often? All the time. But when it happens and a child is not really aware enough, it can be devastating to their sense of self. It can actually be devastating to an adult. When I expected X and just the opposite occurred. Like, wow, what the hell was I thinking? Yep. The dangers of comparing show up in early school environments. I was talking earlier about comparison material in our inventory. Before I take action, let me see if I've got anything that I've already experienced, that I already have rules about, any superstitions or fears or beliefs about that subject. Let me see. Nope. But this comparison that occurs in early childhood can be really problematic. It seems pretty obvious to us, right, that not all children grow mentally or physically at the same rate. It's like, yeah. When kids and teachers and ourselves and parents judge one child against another, distortions in self-image can occur. I would bet serious money that this is almost always the case. If you talk to somebody, you talk to a child, you talk to an adult who hates school, I hated school, or currently hates school, I will bet that it is the negative feelings about themselves that occurred in that school environment is what they hate. I had a client whose child had seizures. Hated to go to school. My son hates school. Both parents were medical doctors. The mother was a cardiologist. The father was a general practitioner. So we're talking probably intelligent kid. Hated to go to school. Why? Because he can't add two and two? He doesn't know the alphabet? No, I don't think that was it. He had seizures in school. What do you think the other kids displayed? Compassion? Understanding? Support? Love? Kindness? Perhaps. Although I doubt it. Oh, he was a young black boy. And he was in Tennessee. I'm just guessing. Love and support and kindness might not have been the key energies that he received. So it's feelings about self in those environments that colors so much of what we do and what we're willing to do and what we're not willing to do. How about our speaking? This is a huge area because this is, of course, how we express ourselves in so many different ways. I could talk about writing. I could talk about dancing. I could talk about a lot of different things. But how about our speaking? What does our ego say about our speaking? The same questions we asked about our thinking could be asked about our speaking. Were we humiliated or laughed at or ridiculed for what we said? Or was there even a time when we were about to speak and we didn't, and it saved us a tremendous amount of embarrassment? I have at least one thing that pops out hugely for me as a senior in high school. I decided not to say it, and the next minute somebody else answered the question that I would have been laughed at had I said what I was going to say. In the first question, if we were pained or humiliated or ridiculed for something we said, we would have learned, hey, speaking can cause pain. And in the second scenario that I just described, we would have learned that, wow, not speaking really saved me. Oh, not speaking. If you want to be safe, don't speak. Okay. Try this. Try to succeed in life and be happy using the concept of no or not as your dominant energy. You want it? No. Let's do not. No, not. That is going to end in failure. Using those as the keys, now they're self-protective in nature, that's what they're designed to do. And I've recognized over time when people don't know what to say or don't want to risk something, don't want to take a chance on thinking or ideas or expressing themselves or taking action, they're going to come up with no, no, no. I asked a guy in Havana, Cuba, I'm standing in the airport on my way out of the country some years ago, and everybody is standing around, there's one chair and next to the desk that this low-level military guy is sitting at. Could I sit at this on this chair? No. Wow, that was fast. There was no thinking involved in that. That was a natural reaction to a low level. Too scary for me to say yes. I could get in trouble for that. But if that chair stays empty, which is exactly how it is right now, I'm probably safer. You'll see that. You can see that in yourself. You can see that in other people. We've all heard this idea, this statement. Maybe it's a cliche at this point. Think before you speak. I would say that's generally good advice, but I think it's really limited. I would rather say, think and feel before you speak. That's more complete. If we had been taught to feel what we were about to say, both for us, how does that feel? You know, you're about to say this to so-and-so. How does that feel to you? And how do you think it's going to feel to so-and-so when they hear those words? Oh, wow. Just that little bit of teaching, that little bit of thoughtfulness, we would have benefited, and so would the so-and-so, because we wouldn't have hurt quite so many people with things that we said. We would have known the effect that we were about to cause. And just thinking, doesn't always make the effect available to us, unless perhaps we've had a lot of experience of knowing what effect those words are going to have. If we have a lot of comparison material that says, yep, if I say this, everybody's going to feel good. No problem. No problem. But if we don't have that information available to us, think and feel is a better approach. I think maybe the problem with a thought spoken in haste, right, is hold your tongue. But the problem with a thought spoken before it's been developed into an idea to me has greater dimension, greater depth, greater breadth, a lot more meaning. It's meatier, if you will. I guess that's a cool idea unless you're a vegetarian. There's more substance to it. And because we speak before we think or feel, it could explain why some of the hurtful words have come out of us and are delivered. The speaker wasn't either willing or able to understand what was going to happen to the listener when they said that. If we're thinking the same thoughts we regularly think, and we're toying with the same ideas that we regularly toy with, and we're taking the same kind of actions that we typically take and we're really familiar with, we probably are not going to have much resistance. We're not going to have anything in our comparison material come up and go, not going to happen, because we've either habituated this stuff or we do it on a regular basis. Because they're practiced by us, they don't trigger fear in us. However, when we reach out for new thoughts, new awareness, when we extend our energy, when we open up and actively seek new thoughts, we're venturing into less certain areas, less predictable, and perhaps less safe areas. Some people are not allowed to think. Don't think, just believe. I had a Jesuit tell me that in the third year of college in a theology class. Your job is to believe, not think. That's when the argument started. Ran to the front of the room and started yelling at him. Obviously had some issues, probably still do, related to that idea. But when we crystallize new thoughts into new ideas, we're creating, we're not repeating. Creating new things can be riskier. Riskier than doing the same idea over and over by rote. No real engagement of our energy, just going through it habitually. I would say it's obvious that the reward of creating new ideas can be huge, but for the fearful, the dangers of these new ideas can be overwhelming. It's obvious that taking actions we have not taken before, traveling to places we've not traveled before physically or spiritually or mentally or emotion, are more uncertain as to the outcome. Will we be pleased with the results? Will we learn from the action and the results, the cause and the effects? Can we adjust and can we make progress? Or will we judge those missteps as so damaging to our sense of self that we have to slam the brakes on? Nope, I can't move forward. I can't do that. At this point, I think we could debug our programming about each of these areas one at a time. When we reduce the threat levels of each of them, thinking, ideas, and taking action, we will become more able to move energy, more able to participate in each step, more growthful, more effective, more influential, more causative, which is going to result in what to me seems obvious, a much higher quality of life for us and for the people we can help. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life. Our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. It's like, wow, if Father Mother Life has this job, maybe I could do something else. I don't have to protect myself every single moment of every single day. Perhaps. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. Oh, the actions that we take, the thoughts that we think, the ideas that we entertain. As we practice that, maybe we could get closer and closer to eventually expressing the divine. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.